a walker among them. Handing out various items to a group of younger folk, he took to be the elders' children, or grandchildren. A knife, a necklace, a spear. They all accepted the gifts in silent respect, the youngest sniffling, as the old man climbed alone into his canoe and pushed away from the shore, paddling off towards the north without a backward glance. His will, Valin thought. Later he joined Asteric at the head of the army, leading Scar at a walk, as the shaman sent his wolves ahead to scout their line of march. "I realize it may be hard to credit," Valin said, "but I have been there, and heard his voice. Much as I would like to dismiss him as a figment of legend or delusion, his hunger for our destruction is all too real. I thought you had to die to gain entry to the beyond." Valin turned his gaze to the horizon. Talking of what had happened at Altor was never easy, perhaps because so much of it still escaped his understanding. "You do. Then how do you come to be here?" Valin glanced back at Darenna, laughing with Kara as their cats rolled together in a play fight a short way off. "I have always been greatly fortunate in my friends." Another week's march brought them in sight of the mountains, a range of steep-sided ridges and peaks stretching away south for as far as they could see. The valley seemed rich in pine, but the peaks were mostly bare granite, painted a pale blue in the haze. Off to the east, a dim orange glow could be seen beneath a low bank of dark cloud. "Fire mountains," Asteric said. "Even the tribesfolk don't go there." "Do your people trade with them?" Valin asked. "Speak their language?" "They speak Valerian of a sort. Difficult to make out for the less attuned ear. And no, there is no trade between us. They keep to their hills fighting their endless feuds, or the Valerians when they come to fill their slave quotas, rarely venturing across the tundra." Asteric glanced up at the ever-present swirl of spearhawks as a group separated from the main flock to fly towards the hills. "Mother will warn of any who come to greet us." But there was no one waiting as they crested the foothills. The heights ahead, free of any sign their way might be barred. "My people would do the same," Altok said, eyes narrowed as he scanned the silent hills. "Allow us to enter. March on until we imagine ourselves safe, then attack in the night." "There are no eyes on us," Kirill said with a note of certainty. She turned to Valin, her expression grave. "But someone comes. My song is clear. We should wait." They camped on a series of hills affording good views of the surrounding country, the spearhawks providing constant vigilance, and the wolves kept in tight packs on the perimeter. But still the hills remained silent. As night fell, the glow of the eastern fire mountains grew bright, occasional flashes of lightning threading through the smoke they cast into the sky. "So Nishak's arm reaches around the world," Altok observed in a rare fireside comment, his gaze lingering on the distant fires. He had recently abandoned his usual practice of eating and sleeping away from the main body of the company, his head once again shaven to stubble. The contempt still felt by some of the centaur was evident in their faces, but others showed a grudging resumption of respect. Looking around the company, Valin noted how they were mingled now, guardsmen and Lonak sitting alongside each other with a natural ease, the gifted among them, their cats snapping at the scraps tossed to them by the warriors. The ice was a forge, he decided, recalling distant days spent watching Master Jestin at the anvil, the three rods of an unborn sword gradually melding under his ceaseless hammer. It beat us into something new. "Did you really hear his voice?" Darenna asked. Altok's gaze lowered in discomfort, though there seemed to be no anger in him, just regretted memory. "I heard it. A sound that could only have come from the mouth of a god." "The Cave of Mists?" Kirill said. "The Melessa told me only one other besides her has ever seen it. It was the Melessa who guided me to it. Though my club and my knife had made me Talessa of the Grey Hawks, husband to six wives and father to a fine son, I was still a youth dreaming of greatness, a greatness I thought I would find in the Cave of Mists, where the voices of the gods are said to still echo. So I went to the mountain and asked for guidance from the Melessa. I was not permitted in her presence, for no man is worthy. But she gave me a guide, and sent us forth with words I thought a blessing, but later knew as a warning. There is only truth to be heard from the gods." Altok paused to regard Kirill with a faint grin. "My guide was a woman of grim aspect, who spoke rarely except to voice insult, calling me a fool and a braggart, and son to a mother who had clearly spread her legs for an ape. Were she not a servant of the mountain, I would have pitched her from the highest cliff, as she well knew."
"You would have tried," Kirill said in a hard voice.
"Your blood mother was the harshest-tongued woman I ever met," Altok returned, "and I married the worst six bitches in the mountains."
"And wanted her for the seventh," Kirill returned his grin.
"Only she had more sense." Altok grunted and waved a dismissive hand. "In any case, she guided me to a cave, a small gap in the side of an unremarkable mountain. 'You'll die in there, ape spawn,' she told me. Then walked off with no other word spoken. I could feel the heat flowing from the cave, knowing that what lay beneath would prove the greatest trial. But I wanted so much to hear Nishak's voice. I knew he had great things to tell me. At first, all was blackness, my torch the only light as I climbed ever lower. Sometimes the walls of the cave would fall away, leaving me crouched on a narrow ledge with the void all around, not knowing if a single stumble would send me tumbling to my death. Then I came to the bridge, in truth a narrow arch of rock spanning a great chasm, with a fierce torrent of water falling like a curtain halfway across. On the far side, there was only blackness. The test was clear. If I went on, my torch would die in the torrent, and I might never find my way again. The gods are wise in their tests, choosing only those worthy of their voice, for a coward would have turned back."
Altok paused, the softest laugh escaping his lips.
"And only a fool would have gone on. And I did." The bridge was slippery, the water chill as ice, and all became dark when it claimed my torch. I dropped to my belly and crawled, feeling my way forward until the narrow bridge became broad rock, and ahead, the faintest glimmer of light, drawing me ever onward. The light grew as I neared, the walls of the great cavern I had entered giving off a green glow, and in the center, a pool of roiling water, constantly bubbling and birthing a fine mist. At first, I found the smell of it harsh, and liked to turn my stomach, but the scent faded as I drew close to the pool. As close as I dared, for its heat was vast. And I heard it, low at first, like a tremor in the earth, but building, becoming clearer and stronger, until I felt my ears might burst from it. I knew then I was a fool, a bug crawling across the feet of a giant. For what would such a voice have to say to a speck such as I? But he did.
"Do you know who speaks to you?" he asked me, and through my fear I babbled his name.
"Yes," he said.
"I who gave the gift of fire to all mankind. I who saved you from the All-Dark. I who has succored you with warmth for all the ages. For I am the most generous of gods, and yet you always ask for more." I would have fled if my legs had not failed me, left me crawling on the cave floor like the bug I knew myself to be. I begged him, like a captured Meremhur facing the just knife. I begged and wailed and soiled myself in fear. But Nishak knows neither pity nor anger. He is generous, but his gift can burn as well as succor, for truth is a flame that burns deep.
"I know what you came for, Telesa of the Grey Hawks," he told me. "Your mind is so easily picked apart. So much anger, so much ambition. And what's this? A child you imagine worthy of a great future. A child you believe will lead the Lonak against the Meremhur. Look closer. See more." And through the fog of memory I saw it. The boy's cruelty to all around him. The time I had found him with the strangled pup. The older boy who had fallen to his death when they climbed together. The lies I deafened myself to as he told of an accident. A missed handhold that led to a broken neck.
I saw it all.
Alturk's head slumped in shame. His craggy features so steeped in sorrow, even Kirill seemed discomforted by it, wincing and averting her gaze.
Instead of accepting this gift, Alturk went on, I raged at Nishak, finding the strength to stand. My son has greatness in him, I cried. He will sweep the Merimher into the sea.
And Nishak laughed, long and hard.
Think on that when you kill him, he said. Now go.
All became silent save the roiling of the water. I lingered a while longer, calling for Nishak to return and take back his lies. But he had no more words for such an ungrateful bug. I found another passage from the cavern, narrow and winding, but also lit with the same green glow. After hours uncounted, it brought me back to the world above, which now seemed so very cold.
Alturk fell silent, looking towards the distant fires with the eyes of a tired man, soon to confront the twilight of his life.
He didn't turn when he spoke again, though it was obvious to whom he addressed his question.
That thing the Malesa freed you from? Did it find him or did he find it?
The centaur had already been reborn before I was taken, Kirill said. Your son had been one of those who remade it, finding others of similar mind, hungry for blood and seeking to justify their cruelty. He hated the Malesa for his disgrace, claiming he could have killed the greatest of the Merimher but for her weakness, for she was old and corrupted by the ages. But they were few in number and their plans chaotic, being possessed of a shared madness. To fulfill their mission, the centaur needed leadership, and found it in me. She grimaced, her voice taking on a note of apology. You would always have had to kill him, Talessa. Only truth can be heard from the gods. He was roused by one of the wolves, a huge male with an insistent tongue and foul-smelling breath. It jumped back a little as Valin jerked awake, dagger in hand, angling its head at him in curiosity before voicing an impatient yelp.
What is it?
Diranna groaned at his side, her pale and bleary-eyed face appearing above the furs. I think someone has finally come to welcome us, he said, reaching for his boots. Asteric, Kirill, and Wisebear waited at the foot of the south-facing slope, a line of wolves spread out before them and a cluster of spear-hawks overhead.
How many? Valin asked, coming to Kirill's side.
Just one. Valin peered into the distance, picking out a single figure, hooded and cloaked, striding towards them without any apparent alarm at the cloud of spear-hawks descending to circle him at head height. Valin went forward to welcome him as he came to a halt before the line of wolves. A man of average height, broad but not overly muscular, drawing his hood back to reveal lean but deeply lined features, and eyes that spoke of a depth of experience Valin now knew to be vast.
Ah, said Erlin. I thought it might be you.
Chapter 6. Reva. She awoke to pain, a fierce, piercing ache in her right hand, banishing the blackness with a persistent, pulsing agony. She groaned, shaking her hand, but the pain flared rather than faded. She winced as her eyes opened, sunlight sending a bolt of white fire into her brain. For a time, all she could see was a faint yellow blur, her ears constantly assaulted by a roaring hiss. Forcing herself to blink, she managed to focus, the yellow blur resolving into a beach, the roar, the rushing waves that jostled her, and the pain in her hand, the result of a small red crab attempting to eat her thumb. She pinched its claw and tugged it free, tossing it into the surf, gritting her teeth against the sting of salt in the wound, but finding herself oddly grateful for the sensation. It confirmed she was, much to her surprise, alive. Barely able to move and lying prostrate on a beach, whilst waves pounded her, but still undeniably alive.
Why?
She asked the father, more curious than angry. You cannot think I deserve to live. You cannot reward one whose lie has killed so many. The voice was so unexpected and shocking in its volume, she thought for an instant the father had actually deigned to respond. Her heart calmed when she realized the voice called out words she couldn't understand. Her still cloudy vision finding the owner, a hulking shape in black, laboring through the surf towards her. The details of his garb became clear as he neared, a black leather jerkin, a silver medallion worn around the neck, and a whip on his belt. Overseer. She let him take hold of her hair and haul her free of the water, keeping her features slack and uncomprehending as his brutish face came closer, eyes moving over her in expert appraisal. He called over his shoulder to an unseen companion, confirming he wasn't alone. She kept her eyes half open as he dragged her from the sea, counting six more shapes standing on the beach, and many more lying prostrate and unmoving. The overseer dumped her on the sand where she forced herself to remain limp and immobile, breathing deep but soft, gathering strength. They made the mistake of waiting several minutes before returning to examine their catch. The overseer who had found her, pulling her onto her back as his companions gathered round. She counted two with spears as her head lolled to one side, the others with short swords. The overseer pulled up her blouse, revealing her breasts, as he voiced a question to his companions. There were a few murmurs of agreement, one of them adding something with an appreciative cackle. "My friend, like you," the overseer said in broken realm tongue, taking hold of her face and turning it so she could see his leer. "Want to fuck you. Might lower the price, but I owe him. You want fucked, pretty thing?" It was really the smile that killed him, not so much the blow, making him frown in puzzlement at her welcoming, lustful grin, drawing back in surprise just enough to expose his throat. Valin had taught her the blow. The priest's lessons in unarmed combat had never been so thorough, nor so effective in practice. Her stiff fingers drove into the overseer's neck with enough force to crush his larynx, leaving him writhing on the sand, bloody froth gouting from his mouth. Reva rolled on the sand, dodging a plunging spear point, then grabbing the haft before its owner could withdraw for another try. She flicked a kick into his face, sending him reeling, then surged to her feet with his spear in her hands. She whirled as they closed, the spear point slashing the disarmed spearman across the eyes, another the face. The second spearman came at her with an overextended thrust, indicating a level of expertise best confined to abusing helpless captives. She parried the thrust without difficulty, deflecting the spear with the haft of her own, and spinning to slam the blunt end into the back of his neck, which snapped with a gratifying crack. She stood watching the others as they dithered, casting wary glances at the man she had blinded, screaming as blood seeped through the hands he held to his face. "Come on," she whispered as they exchanged uncertain glances. "You cannot think I deserve to live." A horn sounded somewhere close by, and Reva's eyes found a group of horsemen cresting the dunes a few hundred paces distant. She turned to see more riders approaching from the north end of the beach. Any thought she might soon be rescued faded at the sight of the slaver's evident relief. The lead rider pulled up next to the body of the overseer with the crushed larynx. The riders differed from the other Valerians Reva had seen, clad in red breastplates and greaves. She would have taken them for curatai, but for the patent amusement on the leader's face as he regarded the overseer's corpse, an amusement shared by the 30 or so riders at his back. The slavers greeted the red-armored man with a babble of outrage, suddenly less cowed now there were other eyes to witness the scene. The rider ignored them, shifting his gaze to Reva, his grin growing wider. He held up a hand to silence the slavers, then asked a question, raising his eyebrows at the response. The slaver with the slashed face seeking to staunch the blood with a rag as he gesticulated at her, voice shrill with fury. The man in the red armor, however, seemed unmoved by their entreaties, reclining in his saddle and nodding at Reva as he voiced a short command. The slaver's confidence visibly waned on hearing his words, casting wary glances in her direction, fidgeting in uncertainty. The rider spoke again, voicing a single word, the other riders all drawing swords with identical speed and fluency. The leader pointed his own sword at the slavers, then at Reva, repeating his first command with slow deliberation. The slavers, now pale of face and shrinking from the many blades surrounding them, began to advance towards Reva in a slow crouch. She saw little point in prolonging the encounter, choosing the tallest and sending the spear into the center of his chest, then sprinting forward, rolling under the wild slashes of the remaining slavers to claim his sword. After that, the others offered no more challenge than a light practice. Crouched in her chains in the back of a caged wagon, two of the red-armored Valerians standing close by, she forced herself to watch as the other captives were inspected. She had managed to scar one of them back on the beach, throwing her sword at the first to come close. He dodged with an uncanny swiftness, but not before the spinning blade had left a long cut on his jaw. She had expected death to follow quickly, but the scarred man seemed to find the event as amusing as his companions. They were already greatly entertained by her treatment of the slavers, slapping their hands to their breastplates in appreciation when she killed the last one, a gangly man who had tried to flee, only to be kicked back to face her. He hadn't lasted long. She had started to run, intending to leap at one of them, pitch him from the saddle and ride clear, but soon found herself flat on her face with a mouthful of sand, a cord tightening about her leg. She thrashed, trying to tear free, but another cord wrapped itself around her wrist. The rider who had spoken to the slavers dismounted to crouch at her side as she struggled, smiling in warm appreciation as he smoothed the hand across her face, speaking a single word in Valerian. Garisai. They bound her from foot to shoulder, banishing all thought of escape, heaving her onto the back of a horse to be carried a few miles to this camp. They had been greeted by more slavers, under the command of an overseer who displayed a strangely cowed demeanor in the presence of the red-armored men, his head bowed as the leader gave curt instruction and Reva was placed at their mercy. She had steeled herself for further suffering, seeing the hatred in the faces of the slavers as they chained her. One holding a knife to her throat, two more standing with spears no more than an inch from her chest as the shackles were snapped into place. But whatever vengeful thoughts they harbored, it seemed their orders forbade any mistreatment beyond some rough handling as she was hauled into the caged wagon. But as she surveyed her new surroundings, it became clear she was not to be spared all forms of torment. She had to strain against her chains and crane her neck to see it, but with sufficient effort could view the spectacle of other captives being brought in and subjected to the slavers' attentions. Their injunction against harming her clearly didn't extend to the other prizes claimed from the shoreline. The first was an archer, judging by the breadth of his frame, stumbling to his knees before the overseer, who bent to view a deep wound in the man's chest before standing back with a dismissive wave. Another slaver came forward, curved dagger in hand, and slit the archer's throat before Reva formed sufficient thought to cry out in protest. She refused to look away as more were brought in, though her body ached from the strain. They were mostly Cumbralians, with a few realm guard, slaughtered or spared depending on their injuries. The storm had evidently wrought considerable damage, for it seemed more were discarded than spared. She resisted the faint seed of hope, nurtured by the fact that neither Antesh nor Arentes were among the prisoners. Lost to the sea or slaughtered on the shore, what difference does it make? I killed them all regardless. The last captive provided the hardest trial, a slender figure with cropped hair, moving with a straight back despite her shackles, refusing to be cowed by the men who towered over her.
Lera!
Reva called out, slashing her chains against the bars of the cage. A slaver thrust his spear butt through the bars to push her back, then stepped away at a harsh glower from one of the red men. Reva strained to see Lera again, finding the scarred daughter standing with a smile as she beheld the blessed lady, eyes shining with undimmed awe. "I knew the father would spare you, my lady," she called, voice bright and joyous. The overseer grunted a curse, raising a hand to deliver a cuff to the girl's face. Lera didn't shrink from it, instead angling her head and opening her mouth wide as the slaver's hand connected with her face, biting down hard. A girlish shriek erupted from the overseer's mouth as he tried to tear himself free, but Lera held on, even as the other slavers assailed her with whips and cudgels, shaking her head like a terrier as she worried at the flesh, stopping only when a spear was thrust through her back, pinning her to the sand. Reva heard a woman screaming somewhere, feeling a hard thumping in her forehead and a warm trickle of blood cascading down her face. A Valerian voice barked at her, and she felt rough hands pulling her back from the bars, now bloody from where she had pounded her head against them. She heard the woman's screams fade, and choked over the sudden catch in her throat. She found herself staring up into the face of the red-armored man from the beach, the one who seemed to command the others. His grin was gone now, and he regarded her with an expression of faint puzzlement, head tilted like a cat regarding a shiny novelty. His face dimmed, and she knew that fatigue, pain, and despair were conspiring to drag her into unconsciousness. She found enough hate to keep it at bay a moment longer. "I am the Elvira," she told the red man in a hoarse rasp. "I have killed more of you than I can count, and I'm far from done." She awoke to find herself no longer alone in the cage. The face of the man slumped opposite her was concealed by a lank cascade of blonde hair, swaying with the motion of the wagon. Reva could tell he was tall, and no stranger to work or war, judging by the strength evident in the scarred and powerful hands resting on his knees, the shackles tight on his well-muscled wrists. Reva sighed, not for the first time, wondering at the father's inexhaustible supply of trials for a sinful soul. "Wake up, my lord," she said, kicking out to nudge his bare foot. Like her, his boots had been taken. The blonde man stirred but failed to wake, voicing only a faint grunt. Reva kicked him again, harder. "My lord Shield!" His head jerked up with a shout, blue eyes wide with alarm, and she noted, to her dismay, not a little fear. His panic faded at the sight of her, though his survey of their surroundings provoked a barely concealed moan of despair. "I dreamed I died," he muttered, head slumping. "It was a good dream." "They took you on the beach?" she asked. His head jerked in affirmation. "A dozen or so of us. I managed to cling to some wreckage in the storm with a few others. We swam to shore at first light. We were heading north, making for the landing site. Then they came."
"The slavers?"
"No, the others." The shield's hands tightened into fists, his chains giving off a faint rattle.
"The men in red armor?"
"We had no weapons. Nothing to fight with." A strange guttural sound escaped him, and she realized he was laughing.
"So they gave us swords. Each of us. Given a sword by our enemies. I fought so hard. But I couldn't save them. When it was over, they killed the wounded and took me. The only one left. Too spent to even stand. They seemed to find me entertaining."
"Garrisai," Reva murmured. The shield's head came up again, his gaze suddenly bright.
"What?"
"One of them called me that when they took me. You know what it means?" He leaned back, some vestige of his old humor showing in the sardonic twitch of his brows.
"Yes. It means we would have been fortunate if they'd killed us."
The succeeding days in the wagon took on a dreadful monotony. They were never allowed release from the cage. Their food, consisting of two bowls of gruel a day and two cups of water, were shoved through a slat in the wagon's iron-braced sides. No utensils were provided, so they were obliged to eat with their fingers. They had been provided a bucket for bodily waste, emptied whenever they stopped by means of a collaborative effort to tip the contents out through the bars. They had learned to wait until the slaver driving their wagon had stepped down from the board, as he took great delight in spurring the oxen on a step or two in order to douse them in their own filth.
"Red flower," the shield observed on the morning of the 10th day, gazing at the passing fields of crimson blooms. "Puts us, perhaps, 40 miles from Vola."
"You know this country?" Reva asked.
"Came here as a boy sailor many years ago. Merchant vessel, before I saw the wisdom and profit of a pirate's life. The Valerians grow the best red flower, and it always brings in decent coin, if you can stomach their ways long enough to strike a deal."
"Your hatred was birthed before the war, then?"
"Hatred? No. Merely vague disgust in those days. My people are rich in faults, I know, but slavery has never been amongst them. Any Maldinian captain found to have carried slaves
would soon find himself shunned and shipless. Reva looked up, feeling the wagon begin to slow, her gaze drawn to the driver staring at something ahead. It took a moment for the object of his interest to come into view, a tall pole set alongside the road, topped with a protruding beam in the manner of a gallows. Suspended from the beam was something so mangled it took a moment for Reva to recognize it as a corpse. The legs were blackened and charred to stumps, the stomach cavity open and empty. And the head. The face was probably male, rendered into an ageless, cracked leather mask by decomposition. But the teeth, bared in a wide, frozen scream, testifying to the agony with which this man had met his end. The driver murmured something to himself, looking away from the sight and snapping the reins to urge the oxen to a faster pace. "The three deaths," the shield translated. "An agonizing poison first, then burning, then disembowelment. Traditional Valyrian punishment for treason, though it hasn't been used for many years." Reva glanced up as another pole came into view, the corpse that dangled from it similarly abused, though this one's eyes had been put out. She asked El Nestra if this held any significance, but he shrugged. "Only that someone enjoys his work, I suspect." By the time night fell, they had counted over 100 poles, 10 for every mile they covered. Volar came into view the following morning. Reva raised herself into a back-straining crouch to get a better view, as they crested a hill a mile or so west of the imperial capital. The road, flanked on both sides with more corpse-bearing poles, became an unerring straight line at the foot of the hill, drawing the eye to the western suburbs, consisting of tree-lined rows of one- or two-story houses. Volar appeared to have no walls or defensive fortifications, the shield explaining they had been swallowed up by the city's growth centuries before. "The largest city in the world, or so it said," he told her. "Though I've heard there are a few in the far west that might also claim the title." The height of the buildings grew as they moved deeper into Volar, plush individual dwellings giving way to close-packed streets and tenements. Maze-like avenues stretched away from the road, reminding her of Varenthold's less salubrious districts, now of course raised to the ground. "She wanted to burn all of this," the shield said softly, frowning as he gazed at the passing streets. "And we would have helped her wield the torch." Reva's thoughts flashed to Lera, as they often had during this dreadful journey. She had been one of the free fighters to emerge from the forest country south of Altor, leading a group of a dozen other girls, all freed from the slavers' clutches by their own agency, steeped in blood and hungry for more. Reva recalled how they had gathered around her, sinking to their knees in unbidden respect. The tale of the Blessed Lady had already flown far, and seeing her in the flesh seemed a confirmation of a cherished legend, a sign that their sufferings had not been in vain. The awe in Lera's eyes that day had been no less bright than the moment she died. Her voice was so full of joy. "She died believing my lie." "The barest chance is all I need," she muttered to the shield. "Just one chance at freedom, and I'll burn this place to the ground." He slumped back down, voice faint and bitter. "It was all a madwoman's dream, my lady, and she made us mad with the sharing of it. Look at this place. How could we have thought to bring down an empire capable of crafting a city like this?" "We crushed an army that should have crushed us," Reva pointed out. "Their cities may be strong, but they are weak, their souls blackened and sickened by ages of cruelty." He lifted his wrists, jangling the chains. "And yet, here we are, brought here to die for their amusement. Despair is a sin against the father's love, for it is but indulgence, whilst hope is a virtue of the stronger soul." "Which one is that?" "The third book, the Book of Struggle, verse 3, Trials of the Prophets." She realized the Book of Reason had been absent from her thoughts since her capture. "And why not? Reason will not avail me here." The Valyrian seemed highly fond of statuary, bronze warriors for the most part, standing amidst the cascading fountains and neatly kept parks that greeted them once they cleared the cramped outskirts. However, the most salient feature of the city's inner region was the towers, great marble structures of hard-edged symmetry rising on all sides. Strangely, this district seemed mostly empty, but for the huddled forms of slaves tending the parks or scrubbing bird droppings from the statues. Reva supposed the absence of citizenry might be explained by the sight of the bodies that hung from the towers by the dozen. Some had clearly been strung up while still alive, judging by the red-brown streaks that adorned the high walls. "Their emperor seems keen to make an impression," the shield observed. The wagon train drew up to the largest structure they had yet seen, a tall oval-shaped wonder of red and gold marble. It stood fully 70 feet high, constructed in 5 tiers, and differed markedly from the other architecture she had seen. There was little evidence of the Valerian liking for straight edges here. The tiers constructed from elegant arches and gently curved columns resembling the stem of a wine glass. "The great arena of Volar, my lady," Elnestra said. "Enjoy the view. It's unlikely either of us will see another." A tight circle of red-armored men surrounded the wagon, whilst the driver unlocked the cage, standing well back and ordering them out with near frantic impatience. From his guarded expression and the sweat sheening his face, Reva surmised he was keen to be away from their guards. She climbed out with difficulty, legs and back aching with every movement. She had tried to flex her muscles during the journey, but such prolonged constraint was bound to weaken even the strongest body. The shield groaned as he stepped down, sinking to his knees with teeth clenched.
"Stand up!"
The voice was uncolored by any anger or threat, the words spoken in unaccented realm tongue. Reva looked up at a man perhaps 40 years in age, dressed in a plain black robe, his dark hair graying at the temples, drawn back from a smooth forehead and lean, inexpressive features. The shield glanced up at the black lad, squinting in the sun.
"Can't see a whip on you," he said. "I do not require a whip," the man replied. "You obey me or you die."
Elnestra jerked his head at the arena behind them.
"Here or there? What difference does it make?" "In there you have a chance of life, at least for a time."
The black lad's eyes went to Reva, narrowing in careful appraisal. His gaze was intense, but she saw no lust in it. Also, she noted with surprise, no hint of cruelty. "My name is Varulek Tovrin," he told her, "master of the great Valerian arena and overseer of Garasai, by the gracious consent of the Empress Elvira." He turned and beckoned to a pair of red-armored guards, Reva noting the massive tattoos that covered his hands from fingertip to wrist. They were unfamiliar in design, much more dense and intricate than those worn by the Queen's Lonak woman, and she could only wonder at the hours and pain endured to craft such a complex web into his flesh. He caught her scrutiny, and his expression transformed into something shockingly unexpected. "Sympathy. She wishes to see you." The chilled stiffness of the wind grew with every rhythmic heave on the gondola's ropes. The 100 slaves below, moving with well-drilled uniformity as they hauled her towards the tower's summit. She was flanked by 2 of the red-armored men, but they seemed content to allow her to turn about and take in the view. The majesty of the city revealed in full, a true wonder that made Altor and Varenthold seem like no more than a mean clutch of stunted hovels. Viewing the pristine orderliness of the vast conurbation laid out before her, she was forced to concede it was the most impressive example of human creativity she would ever witness, every street, park, avenue, and tower arranged according to precise rules of form and function, with hardly a curve to be seen. But the small, dark specks that covered the smooth flanks of every tower in sight told a different story. Volar was a lie, a facade of precision and beauty covering a vile truth. The gondola halted at a balcony, perhaps 20 feet short of the tower's pinnacle. A female slave of distracting beauty greeted Reva with a formal bow, turning to lead her inside, the guards following close behind. The interior was dimly lit with a scattering of oil lamps, silk drapes of various hues covering the windows, and painting the decor a colorful melange that swayed as the wind swirled around the tower. Despite the gloom and the confusion of color, it took Reva only a second to find the Empress, her eyes long attuned to seeking out the greatest threat in any room. She sat on a stool before a small table, wearing a plain gown of white, her bare feet poised on the marble floor, toes flat, and heels elevated, like a dancer. In one hand, she held a length of fabric, constrained in a circular frame of some kind. Her other hand, wielding a needle and thread. Her face was shadowed, the elegant profile drawn in intense concentration as her hands worked the thread through the fabric. Reva's gaze took in the sight of a dozen or more frames scattered about the floor, each adorned with a mass of irregular, clumsy stitches. Some were ripped, and the frames that held them shattered. Reva wondered why the slave girl hadn't cleared them away. "You have been using my name," the sewing woman said, not glancing up from her task. Reva said nothing. Hearing the slave girl's suppressed whimper, she turned to find her face tense with warning and barely suppressed tears. She gave an almost imperceptible shake of her head, eyes bright with a silent plea. "I'll find no mercy here in any case," Reva wanted to tell her, "but thank you for your concern." "So Lisa likes you?" Reva turned to see the woman now addressing her directly. Her hands were enfolded in the fabric, a bright spot of blood spreading out from the needle embedded in the woman's finger. If she felt it, she gave no sign, offering Reva a smile of apparently genuine warmth as she rose and came closer. "I can sense her very deep regard," she said, halting just beyond the reach allowed by Reva's chains. She was taller than Reva by a few inches, her form toned and athletic. She appeared little more than 20 years in age, but one glance at her eyes, and Reva knew she was in the presence of something far older. Something, she knew with grim certainty, that possessed a gift Valin had lost at Altor. "But is it returned, I wonder?" The woman angled her head, eyes closed as if listening to something, her smile becoming faint, wistful. "Ah, so sorry, Lisa dear, but her heart is taken by another. She does feel a flicker of lust for you, though, if it's any consolation. Love may claim our hearts, but lust will always claim our bodies. It is the traitor that lurks in every soul." She opened her eyes again, smile gone as she frowned in sudden confusion. "Did I say that, or did I read it somewhere?" She stood in apparent bafflement for some time, unmoving but for a spasming tension to her face, eyes shifting from side to side in rapid jerks, mouth moving in an unheard dialogue until, as abruptly as it had begun, the confusion faded. "Embroidery," she said, holding up the frame with its inexpert needlework, Reva noting the multiple brownish stains on the material and the dried blood on the Empress's fingertips. "The wealthy women of Myrtesk were renowned for it. My father thought it the most productive use of time for a young lady of good birth." The Empress looked at the fabric, sighing in frustration. "But not in my case. It was the first of father's many disappointments. Still, I am improving, don't you think?" She held out the frame for Reva's inspection. Amongst the bloodstains, Reva made out some green and red thread, tightly bunched into what might have been a rough approximation of a flower. She said, "A blind ape could do better." The slave girl, Lisa, gave another involuntary gasp, eyelids blinking rapidly as she lowered her gaze, unwilling to witness what came next. "Oh, stop mewling," the Empress told her, rolling her eyes. "Don't worry.